Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, joins us for the weekly update here at JM in the AM. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to the show.
Hi. Good morning to you.
Good morning. I heard that there was a celebration in Israel for 5th President of Israel Yitzhak Navon's 90th birthday, and Shimon Peres, the current president, in his tribute to him says, "I was a student of Ben-Gurion. President Navon was a teacher of Ben-Gurion." is that exaggeration or completely rewriting history?
It's not exactly an exaggeration. It is true that Navon served as the secretary to Ben-Gurion. And I have to tell you, if you've ever had the privilege of hearing him speak about those days and the insights that he offered in terms of what really happened, and the he has an incredible sense of humor, even at his age. I saw him just 10 days ago, and he's quite remarkable, as is Shimon Peres, at not too far behind.
Right, you mean in terms of right, he's 88.
He's 88.
Yeah, that's why it's funny. That's why I'm saying that, you know, I guess in his role he considered him a teacher, but I thought it was a funny distinction to point out. And the good news is that we get to remember that we still have some of the heroes of yesteryear with us, in this case talking about President Navon, and we should take advantage of that at any opportunity. There are some amazing people who are still connected to the past. You know, as the generations go by, I know you're one who advocates making sure to get the messages of the previous generations inculcated into our own lives.
And when you hear it from somebody like that, you get such a different picture. I know the book that Yudav Ner wrote about the prime ministers has become a real hit, because people, for the first time, get an insight into the behind the scenes, the things that we experience every day sometimes and you know, hardly take note of, and it gives you a whole different perspective.
Last week I asked you if the President of the United States wants the Syrian leader out, and now it seems that this trend is catching on, that everybody wants him out, including plenty of protesters in his own country. Israel released an interesting statement, or a strange statement, this week that they won't intervene in the Syrian uprising. And my question is, what was the premise? Why would anybody think that Israel would take any role in this?
Because the Syrians are constantly accusing Israel of being behind the demonstrations, and that others have said that Israel will intervene if they think things are going the wrong way there.
Intervene in what?
Because they have great interest.
Intervene in what way, though?
Militarily, or otherwise, I guess, internally. But the Israel all along has said that it has no interest in getting involved in the internal affairs of Syria. Clearly, they have a great interest in what happens there and what the outcome is. But on the earlier part, we're still seeing the mixed signals coming from Europeans and the administration, where they talk about still sitting with the opposition. Turkey this week came out with a strong statement urging Assad to step down. But the Europeans kept talking about him being able to meet with the opposition, institute reform, maybe remaining in power. There was a terrible night last night with many people killed in Syria, the fights in Homs and Hama and other places. But this week, for the first time, you had it in Damascus itself. It spread to Damascus. There were a number of people killed. But when the business district sees these kind of manifestations, like we've seen in other parts, 32 people were killed, I think, last Friday. Right. 23 of them were killed in Damascus. And the significance of that is really quite great. They're also in terrible financial straits. They're trying to get about $6 billion in financial help from Iran, but Iran is being strapped as well today financially because of some of the sanctions and the demands on it. So there is talk of increasing sanctions against Syria, hitting particularly their energy revenue, which is a critical part of their budget.
And sanctions would or would not include European countries?
That's a good question. Europeans are talking about doing their own sanctions because neither the United States or Syria or the Europeans were able to get it through the Security Council because of the Russians and Chinese. So the answer is that the Europeans are talking about sanctions. Whether they'll be the same thing is a good question.
So it's like Syria is primed for a knockout punch. And now the question is, how much will the opponent use the opportunity and take advantage of the opportunity?
Will they really lower the boom? Right. And the And it's interesting to see some of the nature of some of the protests in Syria. They spread to Tripoli in Lebanon, where people marched demonstrating against the Persian project, meaning Iranian interference, and trying to dominate Syria. We've seen them burning pictures again of Nasrallah, of Hezbollah. They are accusing of interfering. The Syrians massed troops near the Lebanese border, a place where many of the Syrian troops had defected to and were gathering there. So the Lebanese, the Syrian army attacked it during the week. The other thing is that we're seeing a big flow of arms to Hezbollah from Syria, which means either they're getting it from Iran. We understand that Libya is also becoming a jumping-off point for weapons to Hezbollah and perhaps to Hamas. But the increased flow of these weapons through Damascus has and increasingly more sophisticated missiles coming from Syria.
And that's in exchange for cash, I assume.
That's probably true.
And if that's the case, I mean, where does Hezbollah have all this money?
Iran. Iran is paying for it.
But you just told us about the financially strapped Iran.
Yeah, but for this, this is not...
this is not an issue. This they find money for.
This is a side cash.
It's funny because... And appreciate this analysis for a moment, because I think a lot of people out there need to know where Israel stands on this. You know, we've years and years ago, decades ago, before peace treaties with Egypt especially... Israel always looked at their enemies as one big alliance, right? It wasn't just that they were, you know, gearing up on different borders to be, you know, defended, but they had to look at the big picture, so to speak. And then, of course, Egypt, Jordan, it looked like, you know, Israel could deal with each state or each country that's next to them as, you know, an isolated enemy, so to speak, or an isolated potential adversary. What is it like now? And, you know, you go into the Israeli military cabinet, you know, let's say within the last year or since the Egyptian uprisings, et cetera. Are we way back into that mentality of, you know, this is one group of potential enemies and we have to look at this more as an alliance than ever before?
I would say at the beginning of the year, the alliance issue was more important because you had the Syrian, Iranian, perhaps Iraqi, but certainly Lebanese, Hamas, Gaza connection and the alliance. Since then, because of Syria's incapacitation and preoccupation, and Iran looking at this and feeling that they may lose their key ally, has been investing much more in Iraq, which we should talk about because now it's being openly discussed for the first time, including by our Secretary of Defense, as an Iranian war against the United States. But put that aside for a minute. For Israel, obviously the biggest change is in Egypt. Lebanon,
right.
The Nasrallah's takeover is very significant. The fact that now you have the army and the government being essentially under the control of Hezbollah, even with Makati as a front, but he's not the guy really in control. So for Israel, Lebanon is important. We see the battle now over the maritime borders, which obviously has implications because of billions of dollars in energy resources in the areas that would be in dispute. And Israel, has responded because under international law, if somebody claims an international border, a maritime border, and you don't protest, then it's shtika kohoda, as the Talmud says.
Right.
It means it's seen as acquiescence. So Israel has responded, and Hezbollah has threatened to destroy anything that Israel puts there. They do have maritime units. So that's Lebanon. Syria, of course, they're worried about who will take over and what will follow because that border has been very quiet for 30 years. The big issue, of course, is Egypt. They are concerned about Jordan. They're worried that the king is under increasing pressure. God forbid that government would fall in a country that's two-thirds Palestinian, very radical. There would be a great concern and a huge defense issue for Israel. But the big one is Egypt. And they're seeing all of the instability in Egypt, the question of what happens in Sinai, where you had a complete breakdown of authority, Gaza being courted, the Iranians reaching out to Egypt, where they had a contentious relationship, and the Egyptians reaching out to Iran. This past week, though, there's a lot of talk about the military trying to hold on to power directly, indirectly, the postponement of the elections, which was essential because only the Muslim Brotherhood was in a position to really field a team. You have 40 parties running. You have tremendous divisions within the various parties, and the economic situation, 40% of the people earn $2 or less.
Right.
The foods have prices of basic foods have gone up 100%. A big portion of the budget is subsidies for food, which if removed would create tremendous instability and riots and reaction, as we saw at the beginning of all of these issues. These details are important because for Israel, 50% of its defense planning will have to go to dealing with a threat from Egypt, given the size nature. Right now, there's no perception of any threat, and Egypt's not going to war. The Muslim Brotherhood is divided. You see the young versus old. We see other divisions. The problem is that in elections, because the other sides are even more divided, they still would gain a very significant hold. So I think the army is right now looking at its interests, and its interests include about 30% of the economy, it's estimated.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say right now it's a very insecure situation.
Is Mubarak in a coma?
I don't know.
And
I've seen the reports from the doctors, yes and no, but you don't hear from him. So.
And is it legitimate when President Obama declares that it's always been U.S. policy to directly speak face-to-face with people like the Muslim Brotherhood?
That is an interesting question, one that I've had discussions with administration about. They say that they've been talking to the Muslim Brotherhood for many years since they foresaw violence. When I showed them the statements that some of them made in Iran just over the last couple of weeks, where they certainly weren't forswearing violence against Israel, he said, look, it's not a, they're saying it's not a monolith, that it's there are divisions within them. They're not holding public sessions. They're not endorsing them, but that they've had communication with them along the continuing. And I challenged about what this does and what the message that it sends to the other forces in Egypt. It's as if, you know, we sort of give them a heksher or some sort of okay,
right,
by our meetings with them.
Yep. Hope the administration understands that. they're basically giving approval. It's America's
way,
one.
You know that
give me 1 second. It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program. Heard and listened to, sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope. Around the world on the web, jmn.org. I want to do good news at the top of the hour, but you wanted to say about Egypt? Go ahead.
No, I just wanted to say something funny. You know that they're building a bridge from Saudi Arabia to Egypt. It's going to be a $5 billion project across the Straits of Tehran, a 20-mile bridge that will go from Sharm el-Sheikh, essentially, to Ras Hamid in northwestern Saudi Arabia.
Why?
Because of the people going on Hajj, and they're going to charge them a toll that they hope they will make back their money.
Unbelievable.
Yes, I think it's a great story.
Everyone's got an angle, huh?
Right.
Are you aware of this article? And I thank the friend, he knows who he is, the person who made me aware of this article. Are you aware of this article about the finding in Ir David of a pa'amon, of a bell, I guess you'd say, from the clothing of the Kohen Gadol, I guess, from the Second Temple era. Are you aware of this?
Well, there was a pa'amon found a couple of years ago that is on display in, not a pa'amon, a pomegranate, that was found a number of years ago and is on display in the Israel Museum. I don't know about this discovery, and usually I'm pretty much on top of them.
Yeah, this one says pa'amon ha-Kohen ha-Gadol, and it says it's made of pure gold. It was discovered in Ir David, and it's, according to one of the archaeologists, you could search your entire lifetime, there's a quote in Hebrew, you could search your entire lifetime, and you will never find a find like this.
It's amazing.
It is amazing. It comes from the Second Temple era, found in Ir David, and it's a Ynet article that goes back to the 21st of July. So many people want to know what you think of the Murdoch scandal and its aftermath and where it's going from here. Not only about the whole, you know, Murdoch's publications generally support Israel and things like that, but in general, you know, watching such a significant part of the media under this type of scrutiny.
Well, I think that, you know, for our community in particular to remember with Hakarat HaTov, to remember that Rupert Murdoch is a great friend of Israel, been a great supporter and of the Jewish community, that his publications with the Wall Street Journal, Fox, others have been much fairer in their coverage of Israel than most of the media, And he gave a speech, if you remember, within the past year, maybe 6-7 months ago, that it was really a landmark speech addressing the whole issue of delegitimization and its significance.
Right.
And so we shouldn't forget it. And so far, nothing has been connected to him directly. The hacking, I think, is extremely offensive and worrisome. And so far, there's no proof they did it here, but that's being investigated. So it has nothing to do with the charge and the substance of the accusations, which are, I think, are serious and are certainly being addressed. But so far, we should nothing has and they had the hearings yesterday in the House of Commons, the British Parliament. There was nothing that even hinted at an accusation that he knew or any emails showing a connection.
You think they'll start investigating the Israeli media for tactics like this?
Everybody knows it, so I don't know why.
Well, be careful.
I don't know that they hack, but that they that fair and balanced isn't always the characterization of it.
Right, yeah, that's for sure. And in terms of, so, I mean, there are the, I mean, you commented on this. You commented on this earlier in the week when you were asked about, you know, sort of losing a friend in the media or, you know, how are we going to, understanding the fact that somebody who's been so influential and so pro-Israel is in this type of hot water. But in terms of the Jewish or Israeli angle, you would say what? It's not that big of a deal?
I would say that, look, the people who run the papers and Fox News, they weren't doing it because he sat there overseeing them. An owner can help set a culture, a general direction, but he has nothing to do with the day-to-day operations. You know, he ran, you know, newspapers and media all over the world. He has no direct involvement, and others in his organization are not quite as friendly. So I think the people there in these publications and in this media themselves and will remain have been sympathetic or certainly much more oriented towards fairness in their reporting on the Middle East.
New York Times, Israeli naval forces boarded a French yacht off Gaza coast on Tuesday as the yacht tried to breach the Israeli maritime blockade of the Palestinian enclave. The forces met no resistance. Israeli military officials said and steered the yacht toward the Israeli port of Ashdod. So last Friday I asked you for a flotilla update and because air flotillas and the flotillas by sea, et cetera, and it seemed like the ones by sea had been suspended. Was this simply a leftover of the flotilla?
Exactly, and I said that there might be one ship that would be going, and this was a ship called Dignité Al Karama. It came out of France. It was in Greece. Some of the stragglers, 10, 11 people, got on the boat, went to Gaza. Israel met them. There was no resistance. They did it very cleverly, and they had instant coverage, instant reporting from their side, not allowing broadcasts from the other to dominate. And I think we will still see more stragglers and other attempts, because this is purely about propaganda. It's not about aid. It's not about concern for the population in Gaza, where they just opened the second and the largest mall this week with all sorts of boutique shops and fancy clothing and other things available. Certainly not a situation of the hunger or the terrible situation that they decry. But this is about propaganda, not about assistance.
And you'll only see resistance when it's planned resistance.
That's exactly right. And also the Israelis learned lessons in how to deal with these situations. And it's often how you portray it and taking control of the situation, including about how it's pictured.
Can you tell me about this strategy by Mahmoud Abbas? He said this yesterday. Palestinians were seeking membership in the UN so they could enter negotiations with Israel as equal partners. Now, I know this is not a new strategy. He's come up with a million different reasons why it would be a good idea to unilaterally declare a Palestinian state. But this whole notion of, you know, equal playing field, is that going to advance this cause any further, or just, you know, it's not a strategy that has the potential to work?
Well, first of all, he won't be recognized as a state of member of the United Nations, because it looks like they will bypass the Security Council, go to the General Assembly, and what he wants essentially there is a moral declaration. They may seek to get recognition for a Palestinian state in the 67 borders, which Jerusalem is the capital. They may try to go for more. they will have an automatic majority. The question is, can we keep them from getting a supermajority? Can we keep key countries, especially the Europeans and others, the joy in the United States, Canada, and those who have already come out, Romania?
Right.
But, and there is a split within the EU where you have countries like the Netherlands, Germany, the Czech Republic, Poland, Romania, others fighting against the other countries, Italy, by the way.
Wait, one second. On which side? I assume anti-state.
That's the pro-Israel.
Anti-state.
And you have France leaning the wrong way, together with Britain and many of the other countries, certainly the Scandinavians, et cetera, Luxembourg, who are on the wrong side demanding a tougher position from the EU. The significance of developments this week, I think, also include the fact that two of the key members of the PLO, a member of the PLO Central Council, Nabil Amir, and even Saeed Barakat, who's been a primary proponent of this, have raised questions about whether they should delay, whether this is the right timing. They know that the day after, they're going to face a serious problem, and the disappointment of the people. They know that the Congress has come out very strongly, and yesterday, in the discussions in the House, where they adopted a remarkable budget, where they cut about $5 billion in the State Department budget, but Israel's $3 billion remains intact, and where they call for Jerusalem being recognized, moving the embassy by 2014, and many other things, saying any document of the United States has to declare Jerusalem, it has to say Jerusalem Israel. As you know, that is not the practice,
right,
despite previous legislation. So that was, a lot of people deserve credit. Elliot Engel introduced a couple resolutions, Alana Ross Layton, many others. So I hope people take a few minutes to read it. But the UDI is still on track. We don't know right now which option, because he can always go back to the Security Council, maybe force it a veto by the United States, or go for a lesser resolution that will simply be a declaration from the Security Council saying, you know, that there's sympathy for the 67 lines, et cetera. Right now, that does not appear to be the case. He says he wants to push for it because it will give him standing to go to the International Court of Justice to bring charges against Israel, give them membership perhaps in some of the specialized agencies. They could get their membership status upgraded to an observer member like the Vatican. So that is another possibility of what they will seek to do, but all of these are really not giving them membership and not changing their status ultimately.
Even as I look now, I can't find any articles about the congressional vote from yesterday. It was yesterday, right?
Right, last night. And last night they finished the bill, but there are articles. If everybody reads, I know, the dailyalert.org.
Ooh, was it in the Daily Alert?
Yeah.
Oh,
we'll have,
whoops.
I think it's on yesterday's Daily Alert.
Oh, boy.
An article about the foreign aid bill.
Sounds like you're suggesting I'm ill-prepared.
No, I'm suggesting all your people should also read the dailyalert.org if they do Jewish World Review, et cetera.
See, if I would read the Daily Alert, then people would say we're in conspiracy on the topics that I bring up each week.
Yeah, it's much better that you don't. I'm just talking about you.
Right. No, I know you're
I
right.
I don't want you to read it.
I know. I'm kidding around. The boycott law. You know what? Let's do the housing crisis first. Is Israel or Tel Aviv specifically in such a housing crisis that it's leading people to react the way they are?
Yes, there is a shortage of affordable housing. It's something that has existed for decades. And now people, in the spirit, I guess, of the spring that is sweeping the Middle East, are acting in demonstrative ways, and especially young people. And Netanyahu has expressed sympathy for them and urged people to go, instead of demonstrating near his office, to go and demonstrate at the Knesset and force the reforms that he's trying to put through. So it is a problem, and hopefully it will be resolved. There's only about tens of thousands of units.
This sounds like his type of topic. I mean, this is...
Exactly, right.
This is where his expertise lies.
Right. But you know, the bureaucracy there is so impossible that people want to build, you know, till the delays and everything.
Right.
But there is a lot of construction going on.
Yeah.
As anybody who drives places sees. But, you know, there's also a limit. It's not a big country, and you can't just keep expanding some of the cities. They now want to build in Beitar Elite, and everybody's making a big deal about a couple hundred units in areas that everybody knows will remain with Israel, has been designated as an area that will remain with Israel.
The boycott law, so do other countries have comparable ones where I guess essentially citizens cannot go ahead and publicly demand boycotting their own states or own countries' products, right?
I don't know that other countries have adopted such laws. There are anti-boycott laws, including the United States, against boycotting Israel. I think it's very regrettable that people talk about, you know, once you try to segment it, they say, well, we're only talking about products from the West Bank, we're only talking about products of settlements. First of all, that distinction gets quickly obviated.
Right.
Second of all, it's not justified to punish people who are living legitimately under the laws of their country in the area. And I think the debate has been somewhat distorted about what the boycott law really requires, and I don't know why it isn't legitimate to say that there should be some consequences when you take actions that harm the economy, et cetera, of your country.
The question is, I'm just wondering if there's a precedent. I mean, most countries have this type of thing?
Well, most countries don't face their own citizens.
Good point. Yeah. Certain things are unique to Israel, huh?
Well, not just, but yes.
Two bills to probe leftist groups were voted down in the Knesset yesterday, 57-28, following a long and acrimonious debate. This is what we've been talking about for months. Especially when we refer to the work of Imtiarzu. You're familiar with it, of course. Danny Danone sponsored this. It's really damage that's caused to the IDF and Israel in general by NGOs, the non-governmental organizations. I thought originally when this was first brought to the Knesset, this would be much, much closer. Didn't know if it would pass. But you see how it was shot down by a pretty significant margin. Is this a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, I think it's a result, certainly, of public pressure, and the media did a campaign, and it has been painted as a freedom of speech issue. I do think that in America, and especially when not-for-profit organizations get funding from abroad, you have to report it. It is scrutinized.
Right.
I think the mistake was that allowing it to be portrayed as being against one segment of groups, in this case leftist groups. Every group should be subjected. If there's a law that requires disclosure of foreign funding and how money is spent, And we here in the United States, we file 990s and other forms, and
right.
Not-for-profits have to disclose how you spend the money, what percentage you use for lobbying, what percentage you use for anything else. So it's a legitimate measure, but it has to be universally applied. It can't be applied to one segment. And the issue was completely hijacked when we know that there are organizations that receive funding from the EU and other groups that may have misused that funding in terms of their activities within Israel. That's what the target was. It got completely, I think, out of hand, and Netanyahu essentially came out against it, and that's why you had this vote, the resultant vote.
Big victory for the NGOs, or at least the ones that, you know, were under scrutiny.
Right, but at the same time, it does raise the issue, and I hope that people, that they will find ways to, even without legislating it, but to set up a system where, you know, outside funding should be scrutinized, and it's not just the EU funding for that, but we know that Saudi Arabia is funding the purchase of apartments. Other countries have been giving money to buy land within Israel by Arabs, and I think that's something that should be disclosed.
There was suspicion that an Israeli victim of the New Zealand earthquake was actually an Israeli spy?
No, that the government has come out clearly and said that's not the case. There were three people who were killed. They were backpackers, and they were not spies.
But
in New Zealand, you know, it doesn't take a lot to get an anti-Israel story even out of a tragedy.
Oh, is that a fact? I don't know that.
That is a fact.
We're far from New Zealand. You're obviously a lot more up on things like that than we are.
I only do facts.
Are you aware of this came from a listener who asked if you could address it. Are you aware of what's going on in the Rutgers University campus in terms of anti-Semitic incidents? I mean, I know that this is, you know, this is not a strange thing when it comes to college campuses around the country in general, but, you know, when it hits close to home, a lot of people start reacting. Are you aware of what's going on
yes,
there?
Yes, and I've been there, and the people of our Lawfare Project are working with them and have helped develop, have given them legal advice, and there are various lawsuits. There are other cases that are being brought, including with the government, about the unfair treatment of Jewish students. The essential case initially was that they were raising money for the flotilla, and the university did not interfere, and there are really strong legal questions about that being a violation of American law. So the people from the Lawfare Project, which headed by Brooke Goldstein and others, have been advising the students, and if there are other campuses where they have problems, they will help them as well.
Finally, Malcolm, I think I ask you this every time we get toward the end of July. We know that it's going to be, again, a very interesting session coming up after the summer at the United Nations. And this year, as we know, if you look closely at the calendar, the Chagim, the Jewish holidays, will not interfere. Does that mean that we're going to be taking to the streets or not when September rolls around?
Well, first of all, we have to talk about what the issues are that we'll face. First, you have the UDI. We don't know where that will be going. And the Durban 3. Durban 3 is being played down. The administration has already announced that they're pulling out, so we have no target here, as have other countries. We are working very hard to get other countries not to go. But even the UN is trying to play it down and to keep it off of Israel. And the argument is that we should not do the work for them by focusing the attention on Israel. There will be events held that day away from the UN, near but away from the actual UN, so as to take attention away. You know that the president and all the heads of state will be in that day.
Right.
And that means you can't move in the area of the UN. Mm-hmm. And convening demonstrations is virtually impossible because you can't get buses near it. You can walk near it, let alone, and many of the streets are closed off. So logistically, it's a very hard thing to do. There will be many piddling demonstrations there, so you get lost in this mass. So we have to consider all of the factors, the substantive arguments, which are not to create more attention, and also in terms of the unilateral declaration. We don't want to hype it and give Abbas more leverage, make it a bigger issue. I think that is a problem for the way it's been handled too often, even by some governmental spokesmen, that we make it more important. And the thing now is to give him a ladder to climb down, Abbas, if he wants it. If he doesn't, we can make the decision whether street manifestations, but there will be many other kind of manifestations, including members of Congress and others who will be coming in. There will be press conferences. There will be events with real victims of human rights violations coming and speaking about what's happening.
When is
to them when at the time of the same time as the Durban 3 conference?
Right. When are your memoirs supposed to come out? Because I may have to wait till then to get the real answer to this question.
The real answer.
Well, two and three.
We meet about almost every day.
2 and 3 years ago, there didn't seem to be any opposition to hitting the streets and trying to gather, 10,000 people at Dag Hammarskjöld Plaza. And it seems like that the desire to do so is waning, and I'm wondering.
No, first of all, we did not do it on a day when the president is here because you literally cannot move. Second of all, I wish the people had responded to the Jewish community as well as
so that's why I say that might be the real reason is you're disappointed in the way people don't show up.
Well, I'm always disappointed in the way that because I think when, people like those who come to the UN do, but in this case, there are other considerations, and the foreign ministry in Israel, others have all come to the same conclusion about right now what the strategy should be. We started a 100-day campaign, and we're asking people to go and visit the consuls general of around the country, of every one of the countries, and we have a list of priorities, but generally, and business people in your audience or anywhere else who have contacts the country should call them about the unilateral declaration, that they should come out now and announce that they're against it. We want countries to pull out of the heads of state not to go to the Durban 3 conference. We don't want the issues mixed. We want separate appeals. But there are a lot of business people who have contacts in countries and in South America, in Asia, and even in Africa.
Today, Turkey
it can make a big difference.
Today, Turkey would or would not vote for the declaration?
Oh, Turkey will vote for a declaration.
And Morocco?
If you saw his speech this week where he talks about his election as being as important in Jerusalem as it is in Istanbul, in Sarajevo as it is in Damascus or in Ankara, he's talking about reasserting the Persian Empire. He is continuing to raise the demands on reconciliation with Israel because Israel said they were even ready to make the apology, though there's a lot of opposition to it. And now he says, no, I also want you to break the blockade. And he keeps raising the conditions, indicating that he's not really interested in the reconciliation that he has spoken about. These are not good people. They have had a setback because of Iran's financial problem, because Syria was a major part of the axis that they were together with Iran in. And now that they're calling for the president of Syria to step down as well. One other point about Iran.
And what about Morocco, pro or con?
Morocco? Morocco is very sympathetic to us. They are part of the Arab League. I think for them to break is harder, but they are not sympathetic. Jordan came out against
them. Sounds like you're working on it.
And Morocco is in discussion, let's say.
Sounds like you're working on it, Malcolm.
I wouldn't put that past me.
yeah, you want it to head, go ahead.
One of the things about Iran this week, which I think is very important, there was an incredibly important article by a guy named Fred Flights in the Wall Street Journal. The guy was 25 years in CIA, DIA, State Department, House Intelligence, and he talks about how, you remember the National Unintelligence Estimate that we talked about in 2007 that said, you know, the program had stopped in 2003, Iranian's program.
Oh, right, of course, right.
And you have to hear, see what this guy, still under limitations on what he can say and having had it vetted by the CIA, tells the inside story about how they distorted it. And in part it was because they didn't want to give George Bush ammunition or a basis for military action against Iran.
Ooh.
And we saw this week Iran shot down an American drone plane over the new facility near Homs, which I mentioned here some while ago. It's in an area called Fordo, but it's a facility deep inside a mountain, and so that they can't see what's going on, so they send drones to monitor it, and this drone was shot down. But this place is able to withstand air and missile strikes, but it's a further evidence that they are expediting the production of enriched uranium. They've said it. They tell us that they're doing it, but again, you know, people don't take it seriously. People, and then you see how our own intelligence agencies are being subverted, and you get this distorted report, which became the basis for all of those who wanted to excuse Iran to use it, even though they knew then and we know now that it was simply not true.
Unbelievable what goes on behind the scenes.
Right, and that's why I tell people all the time, don't assume you know
just
because it's an emotional reaction or because something you read. Believe me, if you knew how different so much of what goes on is from what I see in the paper.
How different the reality is.
Directly are not true. And
right. And
yet, I understand people's reactions, but they got to understand that it's not always the way it seems.
All right, Malcolm, I'm not quite sure about next week yet. I might be out of town. We'll certainly let you and the listeners know toward the beginning of next week, but 2 weeks from now, certainly. Have a wonderful Shabbos.
You're like the rabbi. They ask, what's the parsha next week? And he said, I'm a rabbi, not a prophet.
Very good. So I don't know. There are people who are trying to force me to take a couple of days off. We'll see if it works. I'm actually forcing them to force me to take a couple of days off. All right. Thank you very much. Malcolm Hohenlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations.